But now, introduce our two speakers, Charlotte Ruchet and Charlotte Tupman, who don't need any introduction at all, other than to say that they're both from King's College London, and they're going to talk to us about sharing ancient wisdoms, developing structures for charting textual transfer. Charlotte and Charlotte, thank you.
I can see the question session is going to be really interesting. Every time there's a difficult question, we'll pass it to the other Charlotte. This is a project. We do work with some people who aren't called Charlotte, but on, you know, honorary Charlottes are allowed. The project that we are working on together with a lot of other people who I'll talk about is funded by something called HERA, which means Humanities in the European Research Area, which is something you mightn't get without being told. We applied to their very first call, and I understand that there is likely to be another HERA call fairly soon. The HERA system is that European countries put money into a pot, and from that pot, projects are awarded funding which is not related to which countries put the money in. The consequence of that was that France, Spain, Germany, Italy didn't put any money into the pot because they wanted to get back as much as they put in. They didn't like the idea of having their money distributed in any other kind of way. I understand, however, that for the next project, a larger number of monies countries will be involved. So that's the background. And we are working with colleagues in the University of Vienna and at Uppsala, at the Newman Institute in Uppsala. And this is who we are, that's not everyone. The group keeps on growing. We are deeply absorbent and are happy to absorb and kidnap anybody that we can. And this is the first of a series of seminars that we're giving, which are really about exploiting people to the limit, which is particularly one of my specialities. What are we trying to do? Almost everything in those paragraphs is probably doesn't make an awful lot of sense. But it's the sort of thing that you say. I think we got the money because of the absolute brilliance of our acronym. In the proposal, I very specially said SOARS and then in brackets, you know, expression meaning an old saw, because I knew half the people wouldn't be interested because we were actually reviewing this thing. But they love, key to getting funding, get a cool acronym. Everything else flows from that. In fact, this has been, for me, a sort of personal odyssey. Although for the last few decades I've been working on Greek inscriptions and digitizing them and discovering digital technologies through that process, my first research, many years ago, for various reasons, was on 11th century text, which is a very attractive 11th century text associated with an author called Kepamanos. A text which is found in one manuscript and which was written in the later 11th century. And it's a text made up of advice and anecdotes. It's usually been used for stories that the man tells about life in the 11th century, particularly military enterprises in the 11th century. It has a lot of moralizing advice. And I found, when I was working on it, that I was very, very uncomfortable with how to present this material, both the raison d'etre of this material and how to publish it. So I moved on to inscriptions because that was a lot easier. But I've been playing around with my concerns with this text for a very long time. Gradually, I've got a better understanding of its intellectual origins in a rhetorical tradition. That's something that I've come to understand better. This is a very typical passage. So you give advice, you give an example of how the story might work out. Don't tell somebody a secret, because directly you've told somebody your secret, they've got one over on you. They can blackmail you. They can control you. So don't tell anyone a secret, and then at the end, you get a citation from the Bible. A very conventional rhetorical mode is that one way you support an argument is with an example from an earlier text. So that looks all very good. This is Byzantine text, it's got an example from the Bible, so, you know, that's all exactly what we expect. You can see how, actually, in many ways, this is quite unexciting. But the interesting thing is that the citation is from the prophet Micah. When I started pursuing these biblical citations, about which there's not really anything totally exciting to say, here is a biblical citation, I discovered that of all the biblical citations in this text, every single one could be found also in a medieval or Byzantine collection of sayings. There is therefore in no case an argument for saying that this man wrote his text either with the text of the Bible open in front of him or even remembering the text of the Bible from the Bible. This is true of other things that he cites, but I focus particularly on the Bible because in a way that's where you might easily assume a medieval author knows the Bible, puts down bits of humour. The nice thing about this, about the concept of don't tell anybody your secret, is that you also find it in a collection of sententiae ascribed to poet Menander, said to be extracted from the works of Menander. You find our example, the prophet's example, the biblical example, cited in three collections of sayings, in which, in none of which it's cited under secrets, it's cited under women. Because the passage says, keep this even from your bedfellow, and so it gets transmuted to a collection of statements about how you talk about women, what you should think about women. Because many of these collections of moralizing sayings are collected under headings. Secret, war, kings, jealousy, brothers, women. They're all just topics under which such things are assembled. But it is quite interesting, I think, to see where such things are located. But my practical problem was, I don't know how to deal with this material. Luckily, other people have worked on these collections. This is an example of what these collections actually look like in manuscript. As you can see, the statement, the saying, is set out, is identifiably laid out by the scribe as an entity. This was very cleverly done, wasn't it, by Dennis? We've been swapping slides in among the teeth, so that's a cruel bit, of course. It does raise the tone. So you've got lots of these little worthy expressions, many of which have a long and complicated life, and there is a whole process of tracing. There are two kinds of processes. There's tracing the citations word for word, and there's a much more difficult process of tracing the concepts. Now, tracing the concepts is really interesting, but I think it comes second in the jobs that need to be done. Seems to me the first thing we have to do is look at these collections of citations. I can tell you, if you publish Florilegia, Gnomologia, collection of citations, it's a very good way of destroying your career. And as exciting publications go, nobody buys them, nobody reads them, people only consult them, and what you end up with is a published book where you have a text like the Gnomologia, like the GB text, you have a text like that, and you then have an immensely long discussion in your apparatus of the uses, the origins, the discussion of this text. You end up with a very, very fat book publishing what was a much smaller manuscript, and nobody wants to read it. It marks you by just being incredibly scholarly, but it doesn't really cut the mustard. And one of the things that's interested me for a long time is there a way of getting people to edit these texts, of facilitating the editing of these texts? Similar texts exist in Arabic, and why I particularly like this is because it's an example of medieval markup. The text has been marked up in that you can see by the rubrication of where each of, and he said, when each of the next citations comes. So we have collections of texts of this kind in Greek, in Latin, in Slavonic, in Arabic. They exist in lots and lots and lots of medieval languages. They are the natural response to manuscripts being expensive, actually. They are the natural response. They are a reasonable way of organizing material that you want. We know that many people owned such collections. But many, many manuscripts survive. Editing them presents a real practical problem. And referring to them is very difficult because so few have actually been published. So that was a whole series of problems, and it wasn't clear to me what we should do until, of course, I discovered the digital world, which is one of these things that happens to people. So I wanted to know how to publish something like that, and it seems to me that an apparatus that looks like this, Proverbs 16:5, it's found in these Flora Legia because they happen to have published and I happen to have found them, is a really unsatisfactory way of presenting material. It doesn't do. This is information that I very much want to convey, which I think is very important, but I don't find the existing ways of presenting it remotely satisfactory. And so I thought, well, actually, I have now discovered there are all these clever people who know how to do things. Let's ask Europe for some money under a strand which was called Connecting Cultures, I think. And so we chose to work with an expert in Sweden who specializes in gnomologia and erudition, and somebody in Austria who is looking at the Arabic tradition of such texts as one of the ways by which Greek wisdom passes into Arabic. Her interest is, are we looking at the translation of complete texts when a fragment of Aristotle turns up in an Arabic text, or are we looking at translations of collections? And on the basis of those pictures we've just seen, we've decided that once you're in a digital environment, the basic unit is, and I'd rather beg the question by using the word citation, is one defined chunk defined by that scribe, as you saw they do, in one particular manuscript. We want to take that as our base unit and then record all identified relationships. It's easy, really. So that's where it starts to get difficult, so I hand over to Charlotte. Literally. We had a terrible problem with the noun snippets, Your Honour, Commander. It's been lots of things. The description of this chunk.
Yeah, we described it as chunk, snippet, section, segments. We're still in discussion about what we should call it. Thank you for the introduction to paper today. I'm going to talk about two aspects of what we're doing in the project. Firstly, how we're going to produce the digital texts, which are going to be searchable. These are the gnomologia themselves, these collections of wisdom source texts on which the nomologia draw, and recipient texts that take parts of the collections themselves. And then I'd like to talk about how we're going to link the sections of texts that we can see relationships between, how we're going to do that digitally. These two aspects require different technological approaches. In the first case, producing the digital text, we've chosen to use TEI XML. I know a lot of you will be extremely familiar with that, but I'll briefly explain what that is. And then for linking these snippets of text, we're going to use RDF and OWL. And again, I'll come to that in a little while. To publish our text, we're using a thing called TEI, the Text Encoding Initiative XML. This is an international set of standards for publishing text digitally, which a lot of you will be very familiar with. It's widely used now for people who are publishing ancient texts, medieval texts, even modern texts. And we decided to use it because it's a recognised international standard and because we wanted our text to be as interoperable as possible with the text that other people are publishing in other projects. What we've done is we've designed a custom schema based on TEI and fully compatible with TEI for publishing our particular texts. So we based that on the description that the TEI gives of how best to publish manuscripts, but we've modified it according to what we particularly need to publish our own manuscripts. And the teams in Vienna and Uppsala and London are each doing part of that markup. And so we've had two people working with us this summer, and I think Uppsala has pretty much finished their markup, and Vienna is on the way there. So we're at the stage where we've got texts marked up that we can now play with and experiment with, which is good. We're not all marking up the text in the same way. Some of us are choosing different levels of semantic markup, so we're choosing to mark up different aspects within the text, but we're all using the same structural markup. I don't know how easily you can see that, probably not very well. This is for those of you who aren't familiar with looking at XML, you might not want to look at this slide for too long. Let's see. I don't know if you can see here. The structural markup includes the layout of the manuscript itself. This is just a section which has page with beginnings, line beginnings, and then within that, we're marking up these segments of text that we're interested in. These are the intellectual snippets of text that the project partners have identified as being interesting, and these are the sections of text that we want to link to other sections of text. And we're marking those up using the element seg for segment. And we've got different types of segments. We've got a general content item, which is what we're calling the basic snippets that we're interested in. And then within that we have narratives and we have statements. So Aristotle said such and such. The Aristotle said would be our narrative, and then what he said would be the statement. So that's just a general picture of how we're marking those up. This is one of the ones that's been prepared by the team in Uppsala, and this is one of the ones that's been prepared in Arabic by the team in Vienna. They've had a couple of problems with marking up text in Arabic because of the right-to-left issue, and Oxygen, which is the program that we're using to do the markup, isn't handling right-to-left tremendously well. So that's one of the issues that we've come across, but we're discussing this with people from other projects, and hopefully we'll be able to find a solution to that. We decided to use SEG rather than quote. The element quote exists in TEI, but we decided not to use that because we weren't saying that we as editors were defining the particular snippet of text that we're interested in linking to other sections as a quote itself. It might be all sorts of different types of things, not just necessarily a quote from a particular author. So we wanted to avoid using quotes to avoid any ambiguity. We thought using SEG was a good general element to choose, as we could then define it further using attributes. And for those of you who are familiar with the TEI, you'll, I hope, agree, but please say if you don't, because this is the point at which we're designing everything, so I'm interested in people's feedback on what we're choosing to do, because it's still in the process of design. So, this is just a structural markup. We've also got lots of semantic markup to put in. You know, we can mark up names, subjects. We're still in the process of deciding what we want to do semantically, which is why you don't see any semantic markup in there. As Charlotte said, our structure reflects, as far as possible, what the scribe has written on the page and the way the manuscript is laid out on the page. So we're not actually producing critical editions, which is something that some of the other people who are working with this type of text are interested in doing. Rather, we're trying to reflect what's actually on the page. That doesn't mean to say we won't be providing things like commentary, characters, criticas, translations, and so forth. We will be doing. I'm not sure whether we're doing that for absolutely everything. I think it depends on what we can get done in the time we have available and with the money we have available, obviously. We do have some volunteers working for us, but obviously most people expect to be paid. Shocking.
They're bizarre. Yeah. I've never understood.
From the markup, we're going to be producing these digital editions, and we're going to be producing the indices and the ways of getting into the text, so the search facilities, hopefully in both Greek and Arabic. So that's the first stage, technologically speaking, of what we're doing. The second bit, which is probably the most intellectually interesting part of the project, is defining these relationships that we've identified between different parts of the text in the source text, in the nomenovia, and in the recipient text. And between languages as well. So these are the different types of relationships that we're exploring in the project. Charlotte showed you this slide. Just having a look at it a little more closely, you can see that each of these examples is a variation of some kind on all the other ones. So these are drawn from four different, completely different texts, and we can say that there is a relationship between them. What we have to decide as part of our project is how to define that relationship. Do we just say the first example is a variation of the second, or do we define that more closely? Do we try to break the relationship into something more structurally defined where we can? We've also got all sorts of problems of different attributions. Sometimes a saying will be attributed to one philosopher by one scribe, and then in another manuscript attributed to a completely different philosopher. We need to think about what we have to do with that. The ultimate aim of defining the relationships that we're finding between the texts is to create a network of information that is linked together to allow researchers to represent, identify, and analyse the flow of knowledge across these texts and across the cultures involved. In the wider sense, we're hoping that it will lay the basis for a study of the cultural dynamics across the centuries that these texts were being produced. Here's a slide showing just some of the relationships that we first identified when we started thinking about this. In the most basic sense, we've got is related to. Well, that's what we would use when we couldn't say anything else about the relationship. But we were aware that there was some relationship there. And then we've got, you know, is identical to, is a variant word choice of, is shorter variant of, and so forth. We, on a practical level, when we're developing our model for doing this, we need to build a vocabulary that's capable of representing not just the relationships that occur amongst the text that we're looking at, but also those that might occur in other bodies of material, other types of text that we haven't necessarily experienced ourselves. So what we're trying to do is to get an idea of the kinds of relationships that other people see in their texts, which might be related to ours in ways that we haven't thought about, essentially. We had a workshop in Vienna when we were trying to do exactly this. We spent 2 days in about 10 other projects?
Yeah.
10 other projects, all of whom were looking at texts that are similar to ours. But it turned out that a lot of them were doing completely different things and looking at them in totally different ways. For instance, the linguists, they were doing all sorts of things that we haven't thought of doing with our text. And if we were going to produce a digital place that they can go to link their text to ours, we needed to think about different types of links to the ones that we've thought of. That's quite an eye-opener.
It was, yeah.
We also discovered that people aren't necessarily receptive to doing this kind of thing, which was slightly disappointing. Not all of them, some of them were very interested, but we also encountered some resistance amongst people who felt that they didn't want to link their texts to other people's in case that they were sort of taken out of their control, which, you know, which is a valid concern for academics. Sometimes that can be an issue, so we have to think about that as well. So what we're trying to do is create a means of drawing together corpus of texts which are related to one another and trying to show how they're related to one another. The greater the number of texts that are included in a corpus like this, I think the more useful they will be to the researcher. It's important that we're all speaking the same language, though, when we're talking about how this is represented in digital form. So we wanted to use a means which was used widely by other people to link these texts. So what we're doing is we're using a thing called RDF, Resource Description Framework. Basically, in the XML, with each of these segments that we're interested in, we're giving it an XML ID, from which that's just a made-up one at the moment, from which it generated a URI which is completely unique. In other words, each segment of interest will have a URI which other people can link to.
And you stress that's each segment in each manuscript.
In each manuscript, yeah.
So the URI is representing a physically existent thing, which is a passage of some letters on a manuscript.
And what RDF does is it links each of these URIs to another URI, in other words, another segment of text, and at the same time describes a relationship between them. And that relationship itself has a URI. So it's a three-part system, essentially. You have this segment of text, you have the relationship that exists between them, and you have the second segment of text. This is a basic representation of that. So we've got three CEI documents, say three manuscripts, And within those, we have various different segments. Each of these segments has a URI, and each of these relationships that we've identified also has a URI. So this is a very small-scale version of what would actually be a huge putting together and linking of these segments of text. Does that make sense to people?
Yeah. I should say that when I talk about this, I usually use a Trinitarian symbol at this point. I say, the point about audio is Trinitarian, and therefore must essentially be good.
The point being that we can link anything that has a URI, we can link to. Some text that we want to link to won't actually have any digital versions, in which case we'll have to give a bibliographic reference for that. But we're hoping that this will build into a substantial resource. It's important that the relationships are defined in this way, because we've got a really complex, I think we're going to end up with a really complex series of relationships. And we're fully expecting to discover others as we go along, and for other people to come in and say, but you haven't thought of this, we need to put this in as well. Essentially, RBF is a means of reflecting, transferring the academic decisions that are being made by the project partners into something that's machine readable as well as human readable, and a defined structure that allows people to link their texts to ours. I'm not going to go in very much into ontologies, not least because I'm not an expert, and there's at least one person in this room who is. But essentially, this system is going to produce an authority list, an authority list structure, to which we can add entities and relationships as we go along. We will come up with an initial ontology, which we can then add to as is necessary. So it doesn't have to be a fixed structure. Okay. I do want to make the point that the number of manuscripts that could potentially be involved is absolutely huge. We're not expecting everybody to be interested in doing this, and we're not expecting to be able to get all the material into this. But we want to make a start. We're seeing it as the beginning of a much larger project that might well go over, you know, quite a number of years. We certainly hope it will. As I said, the value to researchers of the corpus will, I think, improve and increase with the size of the corpus itself. And a lot of this is going to depend on agreeing frameworks and ways of working with other projects. I think that's going to be one of the most important things.
And I think I would say, just in brackets, that what one would hope is that a corpus like this is not that we're going to be endlessly applying for more and more grants to go on doing more and more the same. It's about setting something up with a series of tools, which means that somebody who wants to edit one of these texts can do so knowing that it will be put to use. And therefore, this problem of people not editing them because it's not, you know, it's a career stopper, might be diffused, because you would be adding value to something which was already valuable.
Exactly. One of the things that HERA, our funding body, is most interested in doing is funding projects which are developing tools for other people to use, and all that have a wider application. So the idea is that we will produce editing tools that will allow people both to link their text to ours, but also to annotate the text that we're publishing. And I think that's one thing that they're particularly keen on. There are other people who are trying to do similar things. There's a project called TextGrid, which quite a few of you probably know about. They're looking to provide, they're trying to provide a virtual research environment, which allows a group of editors to work together in one space. It provides a lot of tools to do that. we're trying to do something slightly different, I think. But there are experts who are already working on this kind of thing that we can talk to about how we should produce the tools that we want to create. We're also talking to existing projects, and in fact next week one of our team is holding interviews with people who are working on other collections of ancient wisdoms to find out how they work, what kind of editorial tools they use, and in what ways they want to link their texts to ours. What we're imagining will come out of our project is firstly that we'll produce these new editions, that we will come out with a much better sense of the relationships that exist between the texts, and that includes texts outside the ones that we're specifically working on. We will hopefully have built a set of tools for others to publish similar material, and that this would lead to a better understanding of the cultural dynamics of these texts and the collections. We do need things from other people, and that possibly includes people in this room. We want to know what kind of tools you're interested in as building. Because some of the texts that you work on might well have parallels to our texts, and if so, how would you want to link them to ours? What would you be interested in from a research point of view? What would be the most useful aspects of these texts from your point of view? And are there any relationships that are important in your research that we might not have thought of? Those are some key things that we'd like to ask about. I think that's pretty much all I was going to say. But we're at a stage in the project where we're designing things, we're working out the best practices. So if you have any input or anything that you'd like to comment on, please do, because we'd really like to hear at this stage. Thank you.
In fact, the project started a year ago yesterday.
Well, happy birthday to Source. Yeah. Well, Charlotte, thank you so much. There's an awful lot of material in there. At a very, very basic level, there's two things. There's the nature of the objects, if you excuse me, referring to your manuscripts, like that you're actually dealing with, and what they represent, and the things that you're doing with them and encouraging other people, and the mechanism for getting people to engage with obscure texts that they might not, sorry, I shouldn't use the word obscure, fascinating texts that perhaps, you know, a lot of people don't want to get involved in doing. And you're almost, well, I guess you're sort of teasing it out and liberating them and giving people an opportunity. But I just want to go back to the beginning and the nature of the objects themselves. I thought, well, I could look up Mammalogia before I came along, but I thought I won't bother. Wikipedia. I'll hear all about it from you two. So, plus I read your abstract, obviously. But Greek, Latin, and Arabic texts that these are written in. I'm assuming this is classical Arabic. From what sort of period?
The body of material we're working on, which is a subset of all the stuff there is Greek and Arabic material. We're not including Latin in this particular project, partly because the Latin stuff has been much more worked on. Greek and Arabic from 8th, 9th, 10th is what, well, really 9th and 10th, most of our stuff is going to be centuries.
But tracing the flow of knowledge, I think, is extremely interesting, fascinating as well. What occurred to me when you were introducing them at the very beginning was the nature of the objects, collection of the realm, the highlights, the best bits, right? And what popped into my head is like the sorts of books that were given as source guides as an undergraduate student when you're studying Aristotle, you're studying the philosophers.
They used in teaching.
All the best bits, so that's what struck me. Almost like a bluffer's guide to Aristotle, right? If you're, you know, a millennium later.
Or a bluffer's guide to women. You see,
even more. Depending on the audience.
Because that is another fascinating thing. It's got its own sort of, it's got its own ontology in there.
Yes, it has. And I think that one of the things we want to do is to reflect what the scribes, every scribe who writes one of these manuscripts is composing a collection. He may be copying a collection, but the majority of these scribes are composing their own collection because they add a few more bits in or they leave some bits out. These things are more, at one level they're just copies, and at another level they are compositions by individual people who decided these were the text they wanted to have. And it, I think we want to reflect as much as possible to use the subtleties that you can achieve with digital publication to stay close to reflect the decisions these people have themselves made. I think it's very, very interesting to think about being able to get closer to the man actually copying the manuscript. But one of the ways of testing our methodology, I think, is always to say, could you use it as a cookery book? Because we're looking at moralising literature, philosophising literature, because that's what interests us. But the idea of having a manuscript in which you collect bits and pieces, well, we all do it with practical stuff. It lives on, and that, in a way, that is what cookery books are, or collections of useful little bits of lore, or there's a lot of medical writing collected in this kind of way. So the idea of the collection snippets is a useful thing to think about, and is useful to think about how we might publish it. And then there's this layer which is of particular interest to us, which is the how you live your life aspects, which pass through this particular kind of literature.
Have you explored that making links based on contextual information?
Yeah, I think where we have to start is context.
And even foreign principles and concepts. Because even though these are subjective and difficult to tag them in a consistent way, but it would be useful. I mean, you mentioned that there's chapters of London, Hague, and so forth. It would be nice if somebody would really want to see all the things that I love.
We certainly have thought about doing that. What we want to make sure we do is that we don't put our own expectations on it. So what I mean by that is that we would be happy to tag to identify subjects which have been identified by the scribe in the collection, but we made a conscious decision not to identify subjects according to what we thought they were about. We discussed that actually in our last project meeting. I don't know whether you agree with that or not.
But it may come back to my theory is that what we have to do at this stage is reflect. That one I showed you about secrets coming under women in some of these manuscripts. What we want to reflect at the moment that we want to start by doing is marking up all the relationships within the manuscript. This follows this, comes is before this, comes after that, and is in the section on. And when we've done that and got some sense of critical mass about that, then the question is, could one then go through it all again and say, well, what I think it's really about is, should we then go in and start saying, I think this is really about pride? That's one of the other projects is doing. They're putting a lot of what I think it's about interpretation in. I think we should start by seeing what a whole series of scribes thought this material was about, and then later perhaps start to build on that.
I think you're absolutely right, because really to create a relationship based on conceptual relationship or concepts of it, you really have to understand.
You have to understand the object itself. And from that point of view, it's just archaeology. It's the actual physical object. You know, the statue base is in front of it and behind that.
Yeah. Relationships.
Yeah, that's.
If you have a mega snippet, medium snippet, and baby snippet,
all in the same, basically the same idea. How do they all interrelate? I mean, do you log them as baby snippet is smaller than the medium one, and much smaller than the big one? Or, I mean, are you taking a view as to what is the original as being made bigger or made smaller? Or are you just going to use it as a guide, look for a smaller version, or for a doubly smaller version, go to there?
I think at the moment,
that smaller version would also take you back to the bigger one, without any assumption as to what was the curve or which way did it grow.
Well, my assumption, I think what we all feel, is that at the moment we should try to have, our directional flow should be neutral. Because I suppose what I'm really trying to get away from, right at the beginning, what I want to get away from, this is a citation of that, full stop. And we have used this concept of source text and recipient text because we can't find any more neutral words, we run out of neutral terminology. And also, I think that in the end, there's a level at which that's a reasonable thing to say. This is the opponent. It comes from that, the text opponent.
Sometimes it's impossible to say whether relates is well. People are working on this all the time. But, you know, you can't necessarily say whether this text draws on this one here or this one here, which might have also drawn on that one there. That's, I think, unless we were quite sure about it, we're going to avoid doing that.
But it may be that if we can limit ourselves to a series of very flat statements, very very unnuanced statements. This is a verbatim version of that. This is a verbatim version of the third sentence in this larger paragraph. Things like that. But if you had a series of such things.
It has to be, if you're going to make it neutral, it has to go both ways.
It'd have to go in both ways. You would have to be able to pick it up in both ways. That would be perfectly easy to construct. But there's a later stage. All of that is about enabling you then to start saying slightly more complex things. But listening to some of the other projects, it seemed to me that you don't want to run before you can walk, and that we are very much at the walking stage here, and that there's a lot of... it's a characteristic of working in the digital environment is that people always say, the worrying sentence people say, you could, and that's always a bad sign when people say, you could, codify the whole American literature by next week. And doubtless that is in some sense true, but at the moment I think we have to try and keep this as neutral as we can, as kind of clean as we can, and see what comes out from that.
Can I have a little supplementary? Described as a copyist, he might not, and run two together, or split one in half, putting in the initial in one place, forgetting to duplicate the initial run them together. How do you cope with that?
Well, I think the thing that I'm most hoping to get from people is a series of statements that we can usually make, sensibly about two statements, without producing so many different statements, because there's actually an unlimited number of things you could say. We want a sufficiently limited vocabulary to be useful, but sufficiently nuanced. And so, the minute something isn't verbatim, the excitement starts. And one of the things that we were very much want to discover, particularly from textual scholars, is can we agree a useful range of basic things to say? What do we mean when we say variant, that kind of thing. And I've been, various people have done something that turns out called variational linguistics. But I'm a little apprehensive of going down that route. I suspect the list of things you can say is very, very, very long. It's important that if a text is in XML like this, it could be taken by somebody else who wanted to say far more refined things, And you might just as you could just start with a whole series of things like which said there is a relationship between these two segments. You could just start there. Just go through and just say there is a relationship. And then go back and start combing and refining. And what I think one of the things I want to know is what is the range of essential statements that we should make about the relationship between two segments? It's a nice, trivial question.
Is the assumption, I would say, that you can never get it right in terms of relationship?
No.
The fundamental principle of evolution is that minute or micro-morphological changes result or can result in macro functions.
Yep.
And you've given ample and very interesting examples of how the same statement translates from relationships between men, relationships between men and women, and immediately flips into a completely different set of examples, and what might seem like two overlapping examples of that happen on the two different domains. And so I think the assumption is there in your, the only way that I am aware, of never say overcoming that, but flagging that, is by creating a framework that is inherently almost self-contradictory. That's to say that you can enter the system in two ways, where you can run a query in two ways that will contradict each other. And although that will not allow it to help you to cover the full range of possibilities, never would it, and if every individual example belongs in the context, you can spend a lifetime creating that large annotation for your text. But at least if you have a system that inherently flags, you know, you look at it, and the road inherently is this one road goes both left and right, and at least flags the fact that whatever decision you're taking, you are taking the decision, and in doing so, leaving out, excluding a range of others. So I guess my question is, do you build into this system, and I don't know whether behind your SEG and their relations, is there a database, is there a relational database structure that links them? Are they linked ad hoc? Are they just manually linked?
What links them is this resource development framework. The ontology that we're building will have in it all of the relationships that exist and all of the segments of text that we're interested in.
You get into a chessboard and you look on grain on a chessboard.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, essentially, but there's no reason why that can't include different people's different ways of interpreting things, though.
And actually, one of the nice things about being three different scholars working on this is we're not going to agree on everything. And so it'll be possible to see what Dennis thinks, as opposed to what other... Dennis says, this is the translation of that, or this is, you know, relates to that in a particular way. And somebody else can come along and make another statement, which can be associated with a different person saying something different.
But I mean, the user, when she looks at the interface, will she have, okay, search X, or, I'm not an expert in databases by any stretch of the imagination. The thing is that it leaves you with the open question of how you structure your query. And that query structure is up to you, and in that confusion you know that you are the one responsible for the data, and that the data don't have a structure in themselves. That's why they are a set of relational tables. Is there something comparable in just, and without that, you risk creating sometimes maybe very good ghosts, but very distinct ghosts, where the least behind them is multiform, chimeric.
That's something we definitely need to
but
think about.
Structurally, this is not going to be set up as a series of relational databases, is it?
It's not.
This is TEIXML into that, yes.
I mean, the first thing you'll get to, I hope, is a lovely exam time text, because that's what everybody really wants in their lives. And what we just need more of them. And so at one level, what you'll get to is an online text which has functionalities when you start talking about looking at the segments and fragments in that. I mean, if it's my text, I'll be doing the continuous text, and I will have this wonderful new kind of apparatus which is going to lead you on these long journeys. If you go to Dennis's text, you'll get these lovely gnomologia, which will have all these extra functionalities. What we haven't yet worked out is what the entry point will be for somebody not just looking at the text.
Yeah, and we do need to think very carefully about how people are going to be querying the material. That's certainly the case. We need to think about how the interface works. I mean, we haven't designed it yet, which is why it's important for us to hear about it.
Because the easy interface is going to the text. That's the easy one. And it might take you off a great long journey. As a decent apparatus always should, you know. I mean, that's the whole thing, isn't it? You end up somewhere which wasn't where you wanted to go at all. That's always good.
Any links between pictures? Sorry.
Thank you. You're obviously at this point not putting all the manuscripts that exist in the material onto your...
Strangely not, no.
How have you chosen what you are putting on?
Well, we're interested in. The academic interest is a deep concern. Dennis Seavey, who is our Swedish partner, has recently published the Corpus Parisienum. So he has the whole Corpus Parisienum text, which is a very important collection. He had that all already in digital form, so that's pretty good stuff. Always start with something you've already got. And he's now working on an associated collection of Gnomologia in that time. And he has others in his sights if there's time to do them in the life of the project. But we're very, very specifically saying we want to set up examples of how such things might be. One of the on the source text, one of the texts I very much hope that I want to mark up, one is this Trekkermanus, which again I conveniently already have a digital form. One I would very much like to do is the letter of the Patriarch Potius to Tsar Michael, the first Bulgarian Christian ruler, because that's all full of advice that comes from a Gnomologia, from a collection, from the Corpus Parisienum. So that's all quite useful. So the links are there, ready to go. That, of course, I don't have a digital form. It's only in TLG, so I shall have to retype the whole thing, or not, the case may be. But I would also very much like, we've been talking to the people in Perseus, because quite a lot of the texts which are being cited by these Gnomologia are already in digital form in XML in Perseus. And what we'd like to do is to link to at least one text. I've been thinking of the Asopatian texts, the Abdemonicum and the Abdicatan, because they're all full. They're endlessly reused by Gnomologia. That what we would like to do is to be able to show people at the end of the project, this is what one can do, not this is the answer. But here is a structure for how you can do this kind of thing, and here are the tools for doing it relatively easily. I think that's the limit of our ambition, and it's already quite ambitious. But the core thing is to reduce the totality. But yes, it would be jolly nice to link to manuscript images. If we can show the images of the relevant manuscripts, that's mostly going to be negotiation that's going to be required. If one of our manuscripts happened to have been put online lovingly by its library already, that would be great. But that wasn't the criteria for which we chose the collection. But I mean, that Arabic one was really cool, wouldn't it? But what the policy of the Hagia Sophia Library is on the publication of their manuscripts that anyone gets.
Sorry to harp on that, but
yeah.
How many manuscripts are going to go on to this? How many manuscripts?
I can't remember is the simple answer. I think the Arabic, I think they're dealing with, I think Elvira is dealing with two unique manuscripts of which they don't seem, or she hasn't mentioned that in the photocopy, they seem more unique. Dennis has got, the Parisinum is a cluster, it is reproduced in about three or four manuscripts, and the Vaticanum is reproduced bit or bits of it in three or four manuscripts. So it's very small scale,
right,
compared to the volume of such manuscripts which exist.
Which is in the hundreds.
Yes.
Are they all different?
No, there's a cluster. There's a lot of collections which seem to have been made in the great sort of encyclopedic period of the 9th and 10th century, which is when one did this kind of thing. You know, there was a passion for making these sorts of things. But of course, they go on read. Quite a lot of the manuscripts that are kicking about are later copies. I mean, in the Greek world, these things are very, very important for education. You use them because you want to give a speech in your, probably in your school class, you've been told to give a speech on women. So you look through one of these to collect the stuff you need. Or you give, for humbler people like my Kekathonos, you give them an essay to write, and you take one of these sayings and you give it to them to write. One of the nicest ones is, the root of education is bitter, but the fruit is sweet, which Athonius uses, and which is also found in a lot of the collections, and which was regularly used by the chairman of council at graduation. To my enormous satisfaction, I used to sit there listening to her, giving this little piece and thinking, you know, some things have real continuity.
Knowing nothing about the sort of technology of this, is it going to be possible to have, as it might be, what in a normal database would be fields that you could potentially add that would still be purely descriptive, not including your own categories, but which might be, for instance, all the snippets that form trichoma that are made up of.
Ooh, well, that's what we can see.
Or all the snippets that have a kind of question answer. In other words, I mean, can you want to put into it any formal characteristics that could also then be used as criteria for what is extending what, or which way flow goes?
That's something that we want to be able to do. In other words, we want other people to take our texts and what you're describing would actually be, you'd be marking up the text in a slightly different way from what we do, or adding markup to the text. There's no reason why people can't
but
do
one
that.
Can add,
that
can
no,
yeah.
That's specifically what we want them to do.
Are you working with the open annotation people?
We are looking at their work, because that may be the way too. That may be the way to get our annotation done, the open annotation approach. But the trouble about open annotation is it's a lot easier to make it possible than to get anybody actually to do any annotating. The human element tends to be a problem. One of the things I've noticed publishing inscriptions online is that I've always hoped that people will take my text away, download all the XML and do wonderful things to it, and, you know, analyse it in all sorts of clever ways. The fact it's impossible to do so is very different from people actually doing it. And I think the way that scholars currently think or perceive their activities inhibits that kind of thing. Whereas all we're trying to do is return to the 12th century and write annotations in the manuscript, in the margin of the manuscript. But we've got to try and move people forward to the 12th century.
Yeah, but they didn't have the RIE.
True.
You can't
say
submitting your annotation
to the
RIE. Yes.
Just coming back to the difficulty with oxygen and the Arabic text going the other way. Did you get any help or advice for a converter speak for that? Because they've got the Quran and various other things now to the up there in Arabic.
We're trying to remember who we've asked. We've asked a lot of people. We've put it on various Arabic questions, you know, Arabic lists, I mean, academic mailing lists.
But I'm assuming that the newer texts they've got up there are going to be TIFF.
It's the mix that's one of the problems.
are having a mix of texts.
Yeah, it's the mix of languages. It's good that,
in the same text. You've got two languages in the same text.
Sometimes
you walk. Sorry, that's going to be a problem.
But even so, also the case, isn't it? Somebody cheerfully came back and said, well, every time you have a tag, write on a new line.
Yeah, that was it.
I mean, which is...
Which does solve the problem, but it's just, it's very boring.
Mm. I really, really like the example you showed of the Arabic text. Did I hear a mutter from Juan over there? You borrow it from the British Library, it's like...
But that's right.
And it's got the red bit there to mark when that's a quote starting.
Isn't that cool?
Finishing. Excellent, because that was the other thing. The guys at Leipzig, as you know, they're working on investigating citation and reuse.
Mm, mm.
So they'll be very interested in the Greek text, because that's a marker of creativity, but for looking at the citation, the extent to which they are verbatim and they're not, and when they change. Because as you say, these are handbooks, so although it's a quote from the Bible, you know, they've not got the Bible in there.
Exactly.
And they're using a lay tradition. So, I mean, there's quite a lot of mileage in there, I would imagine, for looking at the variant changes over the centuries in these quotations, because, as you said right at the very beginning, there's a difference between tracing the words and tracing the concepts, and the concepts are not going to be verbatim. So you've got the linguistic interest of the words changing over time, I guess. But then we've got the transference of knowledge, flow of knowledge, sorry, as you called it, over the time, which is tracing the concept. But I think we're going to move to the less formal part, where I'm going to come around with more wine. And please don't disappear, we've got loads of wine and munchies over here. And Charlotte are going to be here for a little while longer. And we get such good value for the two of them. And I've taken away something. And when I talk to my students now about RDF triples, I'm going to describe them as Trinitarian. And I hope that goes down very well.
Yeah, we got to
But thanks again.